Good morning. It is Sunday, July 14th, 2013. From the Carver Center for Public Radio, this is Weekend Ozarks at Large, and I'm Christina Thomas. The Arkansas Alumni Association is hosting Pig Suey Scramble. It's August 16th at Stonebridge Meadows in Fayetteville. This scholarship fundraiser includes lunch with golf beginning at 1 p.m. Registration deadline is July 30th. More information is available by calling 575-2801 or on the web at arkansasalumni.org/NWA Pig Suey Scramble. Ahead on this edition of Weekend Ozarks, one local organization is about 7 days into a 20-day effort to find 20 new big brothers. And a daughter collaborates with her mother to tell the story she heard growing up about life before and during World War II. But first, preschool education can be incredibly helpful in preparing students for elementary school. However, many low-income families can't afford to enroll their children in private pre-K programs. Next month, a new grant-funded program in Bentonville will help low-income, working parents send their kids to preschool. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda has the details.
Today, fewer than 3 in 10 four-year-olds are enrolled in a high-quality preschool program. Most middle-class parents can't afford a few hundred bucks a week for a private preschool. And for poor kids who need help the most, this lack of access to preschool education can shadow them for the rest of their lives. So tonight, I propose working with states to make high-quality preschool available to every single child in America. That's something we should be able to do.
During this year's State of the Union Address, President Obama discussed the importance of all children having access to quality preschool education. Helping spread that access to more children is a new free pre-K program in the Bentonville Public School District. This fall, through their Building Bridges program, the Bentonville Public School District is opening 2 grant-funded pre-K classrooms. Administrators have 40 slots available for free to students who qualify. Deb Key, Early Childhood Director, says there are a number of requirements families must meet in order to participate in the program.
Well, first of all, the child has to be 3 or 4 years old by August 1st is the first requirement. The second requirement is income, and the income for a family of 2 cannot be more than $38,818. For a family of 3, they can't make more than $42,542, and for a family of 4, they can't make more than $48,000. $444, and that's a family of 4 or more. The second criteria is, or the next criteria would be, they have to be working a minimum of 30 hours per week or more, or going to school full time. So the income and working is, they have to be doing both, or going to school. So income and going to school, or income and working, because this is a program that's set up to serve working families.
Key explains the program is being funded through a Child Care and Development Block Grant the state of Arkansas received from the federal government. Key says the school district was awarded more than $194,000 to run the program for a school year. But because they want to serve working families, the program will be run year-round. So the district was awarded additional money, bringing their total to around $250,000. Key says when awarding grants, officials were looking for high-quality centers already in existence so they could start enrolling low-income families immediately and hit the ground running.
I was kind of at the right place at the right time, and I think we were probably one of the first schools in the state that just knew about the money. And since then, I let Springdale know about it, and Rogers knows about it. I know Springdale got some funding. I don't know if Rogers got funding or not, but the information is now disseminated down to a lot of different schools.
According to the Annie E. Casey Foundation's Kids Count report, from 2009 to 2011, 52% of children in Arkansas did not attend preschool. That's slightly better than the national average of 54%. The Arkansas Research Center recently conducted a study that looked at the Arkansas Better Chance Program's effect on kindergarten readiness of children. The results of that study were released in May and showed that economically disadvantaged students did better on a kindergarten entrance exam if they had been to an ABC pre-K program. In fact, they did 9 percentage points better than a child who had not been in the program. Key says a child's success in the future is one reason why it's important for more children to have access to preschool education.
There is a great need for preschool programs in Arkansas, and quality preschool programs are most important. But research does tell us that pre-K does have a meaningful impact on children. And language, literacy, and math development, those are predictive of their cognitive skills and the success that they're going to have in school as they get into elementary school. And effective preschool programs do provide early intervention. So you can catch things early on if they have special needs. Maybe they have autism or there are speech issues. Things that can be corrected early on or caught early may be corrected before they get to school. Or, you know, we can just help them before they get to school. But the things that we can do, the pre-writing, the pre-reading, the pre-math skills that we do in kindergarten can lay that foundation for future success in school.
The classrooms will have a teacher-student ratio of 1 to 10, and the new program will use the core knowledge preschool curriculum to help prepare students for kindergarten. Natasha Crosby, curriculum and technology specialist, will be working with staff to make sure the curriculum is taken care of and that teachers are integrating technology into it. Although the school district already has a preschool program in place, Crosby says the new grant-funded openings will help take care of families who oftentimes fall through the cracks.
We have families that come in that are hit on hard times and both parents are working, as most, you know, dual parent families have to do. And maybe they can't qualify for food stamps, they make too much money, or they can't qualify for vouchers, they make too much money. Their children can't get free lunches because they're not under the income, but yet they don't make enough money to really survive. And it's a common societal problem, not only just here in Bentonville, but all over our state and probably our nation as well. But that's what's, I think, most amazing for us, is that we're able to offer it to that group that typically is left out.
Enrollment is on a first-come, first-served basis. Deb Key, Director of Early Childhood, says priority will be given to Bentonville School District patrons, but if slots do not fill up, they will open enrollment to other in-state districts. More information is available by calling 479-254-5040 or by visiting facebook.com/Bentonville Public Schools.
Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda with that report. In Northwest Arkansas, mobile vending is being used as a type of incubator for startup businesses. As this trend has grown in recent years, communities are having to balance the economic advantage of these types of businesses with concerns from more traditional types of business. Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis has more.
You've seen them on the downtown squares of Bentonville and Fayetteville, on Dixon Street, or even in groups on College Avenue. In the past few years, the mobile vending market has seemingly exploded with activity, most visibly in the plethora of mobile food options that have popped up at various locations. But just because these vendors set up in trailers, push carts, or food trucks doesn't mean that the businesses are fly-by-night operations. These vendors have to abide by a permitting process just like any other business. Jeremy Pate is the Director of Development Services for the City of Fayetteville. He says that while there are actually three distinct permitting processes for outdoor vending establishments in the city, the most popular one is the permit that allows mobile vendors to locate on private property.
Essentially, what we do there with our building and development codes is we review a permit application accompanied by a $50 application fee. That permit, if it is approved, is good for 90 days at the address at which it's located. Because it is a temporary type of facility, after that 90 days in that one location within a 12-month time frame, those vendors may move to a different location and open up again. It has to be at least 1.5 mile away, and then they can do another 90-day period.
Which means that vendors could locate at 4 different locations in the city throughout a 12-month period. Pate says that the current ordinance also allows for vendors to have more than one mobile vending permit open at any given time, letting the vendor move to where he or she feels business is best at a given time. But some businesses who obtain a mobile vending permit aren't quite as mobile.
But we also have some vendors who are really not so mobile, like an Airstream trailer. We have a whole grouping or a cluster of Airstream trailers down off of College Avenue and Trenton Boulevard. There's, I think, five of them there. And so they're not necessarily that mobile, other than you can hook them up to a truck and pull them away once they're complete. But they are still considered part of our outdoor mobile vendor business.
In Bentonville, the permitting process is similar to the one that Fayetteville uses, with outdoor vendors setting up shop in that city's downtown area. Troy Galloway is the director of planning for the city of Bentonville.
Right now, I think we have four or five outdoor food vendors in and around downtown Bentonville, but we get a lot of interest, from folks that are interested in doing that, not only the outdoor food vendors, but other types of wares that could potentially be sold through sort of an outdoor vendor type setting.
Once a mobile vendor has gone through the application process, there is no time limit for them to be operating at the location listed on said permit. But Galloway says that Bentonville is attempting to make its mobile vendor ordinance and downtown area more hospitable for vendors to set up shop, making the process more straightforward and more predictable, and encouraging development of more clusters of mobile vendors in the downtown area.
There are potential benefits outdoor vendors to downtowns that are emerging like ours is. We still have some gaps in the downtown tapestry. These sorts of outdoor vendors are very good at helping fill those gaps, at least on a temporary basis, until longer term, where we hope bricks and mortar establishments will take hold. But certainly there is a place in downtown Bentonville for outdoor vendors, and we hope to facilitate that and encourage that and do so in a manner that adds to the experience of downtown Bentonville.
But Bentonville borrowed heavily from a draft ordinance that will soon be brought before the Fayetteville City Council. Alderman Matthew Petty has been working on an update to the ordinance that governs mobile vending operations on private property.
So what we're going to do is allow any private property owner, if their property is already zoned to allow for commercial activity like retailing or opening a restaurant or that sort of thing, then we'll allow them to get a designation as a mobile vendor site. We call it a mobile vendor court. And in order to get that permit, what they'll have to do is submit a master site plan.
That master site plan would have to show how many mobile vendors would be located on the site, where the vendors would be located, as well as locations of seating, restrooms, parking, and access to utilities like electricity and wastewater disposal. Once the master plan is accepted by the city, the landowner would be issued a permit to operate a so-called mobile vendor court, much like the Fayetteville Yacht Club with its fleet of Airstream trailers on College Avenue. With his proposed ordinance, Petty says that owners of successful mobile vendor courts would eventually be required to further develop their properties.
If they're there for more than a year or even longer than that, then we're going to start requiring them to improve the property, just like we would if they'd built a building there. So when somebody comes along, they want to develop a piece of real estate and build something, we require them to do new sidewalks, new water lines, new landscaping, that sort of thing. And so we want to require commensurate improvements with mobile vendor courts because we just think fair is fair.
But some Fayetteville business owners don't think the current ordinances are fair. Last summer, a conflict arose between a mobile flavored ice stand and a nearby brick and mortar frozen custard shop on College Avenue. And just last month, a mobile chicken stand in the same vicinity drew the ire of a nearby KFC when applying for a variance to extend its 90-day permit for the location. Jeremy Pate says that while the city's planning commission tends to approve most variance requests it gets from mobile vendors asking for more time in a given location, city staff must balance a business's continued presence at its given location against other similar businesses in the vicinity.
There's a requirement passed by the city council that states that an outdoor mobile vendor's presence for an extended period of time at one location won't create an unfair advantage over similar and nearby permanent businesses. As staff, we simply can't ignore that. We have to make a finding related to that requirement. And so when we do hear from permanent businesses stating that that's the fact, and if they have any kind of data or information, proximity sales, things like that, then we certainly will listen, and we have to make a judgment call in making our recommendation.
Matthew Petty says that while some of the brick-and-mortar establishments have raised some good arguments about how mobile vendors have an upper hand, specifically regarding lower overhead and development costs, he says that some of the concerns that brick-and-mortar businesses have presented regarding mobile vendors are just unfair, considering the positive aspects that they bring to the community.
If you look at all the benefits that mobile vendors bring to the community, they're almost always locally owned and managed, which means that more of the revenue that they have stays in our community, so there's that benefit. But more than that, when you have a mobile vendor court, usually taking a piece of vacant land or a parking lot, and you're activating it with more people there. And what you end up with is tax revenue where you didn't have it before, jobs where you didn't have it before, and kind of a place where our citizens get some enjoyment out of a place that they didn't get any enjoyment before.
Troy Galloway says that Bentonville planners have been fortunate that there hasn't been an apparent direct competition between the brick-and-mortar and mobile businesses in that city's downtown area.
I think more than anything, they create an energy and draw people downtown that otherwise might not have come to downtown, because I think there are certain folks that are coming to downtown Bentonville specifically for the outdoor food vendors, and there's people that are coming downtown specifically for the bricks-and-mortar restaurants. And I think on occasions when maybe the bricks and mortar restaurants are full, some of those folks that were coming there for that were taking advantage of some of the outdoor vendors and vice versa. So I think so far it's creating a synergy that's benefiting everyone. But I can certainly see down the road where there might be some competitive issues that might arise from those arrangements.
Although Bentonville only has a handful of mobile vendors currently, and Fayetteville has several scattered throughout the city, updated regulations are probably due. Galloway says that though Bentonville has had regulations regarding mobile food operations of some sort for about 17 years, those regulations haven't always been specifically tailored to outdoor food vendors. And Matthew Petty says that the current regulations in Fayetteville were originally intended for produce stands and have been tweaked over the years to allow for mobile food trucks, trailers, and pushcarts. But even though the updated ordinances in the pipes for both cities borrow heavily from one another, no two cities are alike, and no two cities will need the same ordinances. At least, that's the opinion of Marcel Elizondo, a sanitary supervisor for the Travis County, Texas Health Department, the governing body that handles much of the permitting for food trucks in Austin, Texas. Since coming on board with the department in 2009, Elizondo says that he has seen an average of 12 to 1,300 vendor applications come through the office each year.
Not to say that this is the standard. I think it's the rules that we've come up with are rules that work for the local city government, and each city is going to be different. I mean, I had a call 2 weeks ago from Vancouver, Canada, and they have a certain way. Then, you know, a day after that, it was Lexington, Kentucky, and they had just a different way of looking at it. And like, well, that sounds good, but we're not going to go that route. We're going to try a different route, which is fine. Every city is going to have to tackle their issues, you know, whether it's a zoning issue, whether it's hours of operation, noise, trash. Every single city is going to have a different focus on what they look at.
As for new regulations for mobile vendors in Northwest Arkansas, the proposed ordinances should be brought before Bentonville and Fayetteville City Councils in the next couple of months. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Timothy Dennis.
Weekend Ozarks at Large, I'm Christina Thomas. As a young girl, one woman remembers the stories her mother told her about growing up in Paris before and during World War II. That woman asked her mother to write down her memories. Those memories have become the new book, One of the Lucky Ones. Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellum spoke with both mother and daughter and has this story.
For years, Brenda Hancock and her sister heard the stories about their mother's life in France before, during, and after World War II. Those stories included her narrow escape from occupied Paris, her involvement with the French Resistance, and meeting the love of her life. Brenda wanted to make sure her mother's life was committed to paper, and she first attempted to write those stories down in the 1980s.
I had written some fluff stuff, and I thought, well, the serious thing is to get mother's story down. And I started with some memories, and I guess I embellished them. She looked at what I wrote, and she said, well, this is a beautiful story, but it's not true. It's not mine. So I went, eh, and threw it away.
But then Brenda wrote a poem for her mother, Nicole Holland, about Nicole's life. Nicole was touched by the words and agreed to dictate the events of her life to Brenda. The result is the new book, One of the Lucky Ones. Last week, Brenda Hancock and Nicole Holland came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio to talk about the first part of the book and about Nicole Holland's remarkable story. Brenda Hancock lives in Fayetteville, and her mother, Nicole Holland, now lives in Springdale. Nicole says she considered much of her life to be lucky, including the years before the war began. Her family lived in Paris in a building with a unique design. The first floor had no apartments, but was a large space designed with children of the building in mind.
It was a different place. It was special for the children. There was a huge kitchen and two big rooms with tables and chairs. The first things we did have to go when we come in from school is to sit down. Well, we go up to our apartment. Our mothers give us a snack. We would go down and we do our homework first. And then we clear up the tables and put some chairs around, and there's two ladies who were with us. There was like big sister, and they start to tell us stories about the Bible and also tell us we were singing.
It was, she remembers, an idyllic time. Many of the children would walk to and from school together. And since the neighborhood had a diverse population, the school would close for both Jewish and Christian holidays.
And it was wonderful when you're a child. It's wonderful.
Things changed dramatically in 1939. Nicole and her siblings were spread out around France on the date that the French declared war on Germany. Nicole Holland remembers the exact date.
It was the 3rd of September, 1939. And my two sisters and I were in Colville. My mother and daddy was in Paris. My younger brother was in Cabourg, which is in Normandy also. And he was already acting. And he went singing. He was the youngest one, but he was 12 then. Oh, younger than that. And he did have a contract to entertain in a casino.
Nicole and her older sister, Helene, were in a nearby town for their usual late summer visit. They were both in their late teens. Many people in Paris were fleeing the city, but Nicole and her sister, unable to find jobs outside of Paris, convinced their parents they should come back. It's another date that sticks in Nicole's memory, June 14, 1940, the day the Germans came into Paris. She was standing in front of the courthouse for the 4th District of Paris.
And suddenly we heard trucks, and we saw some tanks with a swastika on it. And we stood there right in front of the big courthouse, the main courthouse of all Paris. And we couldn't believe it. We started crying because we saw our flag going down and the German flag going up. And we stood there. And then we saw, my sister saw two trucks full of prisoners.
Nicole's sister, Helene, incredibly moved toward the French prisoners in the trucks. Nicole says this was not unusual. She says her sister was a strong, brave young woman.
She wasn't scared of anybody. I guess if the devil itself would come in, she would fight him. But she saw that, and she saw the German standing guard to the trucks. She didn't have cigarettes in her purse. So she got her cigarette out, and she gave them to the prisoners. And when the people who were standing there in Paris, they ran to the stores and got some food and wine and give them to the prisoners. So my sister said, we were with a friend of her, we spent the night. My sister said, let's get their name of the prisoner and address. And we sent some letters to the family, knowing they're not dead.
Nicole says they spent the entire night writing letters to the families of those prisoners. They couldn't write about where those men were going. They didn't know. But they could at least let the families know they were still alive. She says life during the occupation was confusing and unsettling. There were rumors and speculation, and many people were uncertain whether they should stay or go. In 1941, Nicole and the other members of her family in Paris had to register with authorities since they were Jewish.
And we did have to wear the Star of David on our clothes. So we did have to sew it up. And my sister was taking, how do you say it, courses? No, she was taking dramatic
acting lessons.
Yes. And then I found a job with a doctor, and I was in the office. And he heard, in 1942, he heard there's going to be a big roundup in Paris of all the Jews. And they'd done it before, but this one was the 16th of July, 1942. And the doctor come in and he said, you cannot go home. Because I was wearing, and he wasn't a Jew. Yeah, I was wearing the Star of David. And he said, go home and get one of your sisters to come and spend the night with you. You're going to stay in the office.
Nicole and her younger sister, Madeline, stayed in the doctor's office during the curfew hours, when Jews could not be on the streets between 8 p.m. and 6 a.m. Just after the curfew broke, one of Nicole's brothers came to the doctor's office with terrifying news. Germans had been to the family's apartment.
My younger brother came and tell us, don't come home. They're Gardelin, and they're looking for you. So don't come home.
Helene had been taken into custody, and Nicole's employer, the doctor, helped Nicole remove every stitch of the yellow Star of David from her dress so Nicole could leave Paris. She did, but anxiety about the fate of her family made the 19-year-old Nicole return. Her mother, worried that Nicole would be taken like her older sister, arranged for Nicole to spend the nights in an apartment upstairs with another woman. Every time there was a knock at the door, everybody jumped. Nicole says the strain was too much, and plans were made to leave again. It was August 4th, 1942, and the plans were created for Nicole, her nephew, who was the same age, and another young woman to leave the city. The Stars of David were again removed from clothing, and Nicole and her nephew, Marcel, tried to take on the appearance of students on an overnight trip. Her mother walked them to a bridge near the train station and then kissed Nicole goodbye. The plan was Nicole would get word back that she was safe and her mother could send her more clothes, but it would be the last time Nicole would see her mother. Our conversation last week had already lasted more than 45 minutes when we reached this part of Nicole's story, when she had left Paris and would not return to the city until after the war. There is so much more to the story, how Nicole was asked to join the French resistance and did so, delivering messages that helped the underground, including information that perhaps in a small way aided in the explosion of a German train. She also writes about meeting her future husband, an American serviceman, and her eventual move with him to Texas. So many stories, she says, but too many to tell in just one sitting.
You're going to have to buy the book and read it. It is, you know, unreal because there's so much happen in between.
Nicole's daughter, Brenda Hancock, wrote the book, One of the Lucky Ones, by writing down what her mother had told her for so many years. The book is written in first person, as if Nicole was telling us the story now, as if we were seated at her kitchen table.
Because it was meant to be for my children, my sister's children, our grandchildren. My sister has a great-granddaughter now. And we wanted our children and their children to know Mimi's stories, to know where they came from, the strength of the genes that they had flowing through their bodies, you know, that this little lady was incredible and that they are a part of her. And through learning about her, through basically sitting and listening to those same stories, that perhaps they would learn, like she, to take not, it's not what happens to you in life, it's how you respond to what happens that makes all the difference in the world. And so that was the main purpose, is so that the generations of her descendants could learn that same lesson from her that we learned, my sister and I learned. So that's why I wrote it, I did this and I did that, because I wanted them to feel they were at the table.
It is a remarkable story of courage, perseverance, and adventure. She describes herself at the beginning of the war as a naive young woman, not yet ready for the cold, harsh realities of the world. By the end, she survived the war, moved to a completely foreign land, and taught herself English while living in Texas, and then helps raise a family.
Here's the thing. my mother was different from every other Texas mother, but she was the only mother I had. And so that was normal for me. It was normal for me to have a mother that spoke a little differently. It was normal for me to have this mother with all these stories. That's what I knew. And so, no, I didn't realize. In fact, even after I wrote this, I did not realize how amazing she was until, was it a year ago, 2 years ago? A friend said, you really need to read Sarah's Key, which is a novel. And I went to the library and I opened it up and it starts July 16th, 1942. And I went, oh, wait. So I had gotten in the habit of reading stories aloud to Mother. And so I said, Mother, let's read this one. And I started reading Sarah's Key. And of course, we cried through the whole thing. And when I saw what happened to Sarah, I mean, Sarah's story paralleled Mother's. She lost a brother that she felt like it was her fault. Well, they came for Mother and Aunt Ellen at the same time. They took Ellen and she died. Mother did not. Sarah and Mother both married an American, came to America after the war, had children. But then Sarah never overcame. She never could get past it. And it was at that point that I realized that this is an amazing little lady. Not only did she survive, not only did she fight back against the Germans, but she came to a country where she could not speak the language. She made a new life. She raised two daughters to be non-prejudiced.
An amazing story, but one filled with tragedy. When Nicole returned to Paris, only one of the 13 members of her immediate family had survived the war and the concentration camps, her younger brother, Robert. Many of the children she had walked to school with before the war didn't survive either.
And I always wonder what would have happened to all those children. There probably would have been doctors and I don't know what else. But only five come back. Four boys and two girls.
Decades later, at age 90, it is hard for Nicole to understand why such horrors could have been committed.
My parents wasn't spared either, with my older sister and her two children and her husband and my younger brother and a little boy who lived in the apartment house, and his family was gone, and Mother took him in. And he didn't want to go with my younger sister, who was still in France. And she begged him to go with Madeleine and to go to Marseille and be with his brother. He said, no. He called my mother and he said, Madame Vierman, I'm going with you. Maybe I can see my mother and my sisters. And he went with my mother. And he went to the gas chamber with my mother.
Nicole Holland's life in Paris and France before and during World War II is told in the new book, One of the Lucky Ones, written by her daughter, Brenda Hancock. Nicole lives in Springdale. Brenda lives in Fayetteville. They both came to our studio last week. Both women will discuss the book at Barnes & Noble in Fayetteville on Thursday, July 25th at 7 p.m.
Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums filed that story for a daily edition of Ozarks at Large earlier this week. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. As the population of the area grows, so too do the number of those in need. Whether they be children, animals, the sick or disabled, and even plants and trees. With that growth comes an increase in the number of nonprofit organizations, many of which have fundraising events or calls for volunteers. In an effort to consolidate all of this information, we will provide a monthly roundup here on Ozarks at Large. In a few minutes, an effort to find 20 men in 20 days. But first, July may seem quiet, but here are a few things going on this month. July 19th, a night at the races, benefiting the Arkansas Support Network, will be held at the Fayetteville Town Center. Also July 19th and 20th, Stuff the Bus, a United Way event to be held at area Walmarts. This is where you can bring school supplies for needy children. Anything from markers, Kleenexes, notebooks, backpacks even, to literally a bus. And volunteers will take those things for you and give them to needy children. July 20th, Dream Big Gala, benefiting the Children's Safety Center, will be held at the Fayetteville Town Center. And then July 26th, Brett Bielema will be hosting a 6th annual Swing for the Cure event to benefit Komen Ozark at Shadow Valley Country Club in Rogers. Brett Bielema being the new Arkansas Razorback football coach. So that's July 26th. Almost 110 years ago, a court clerk in New York City noticed a lot of boys coming through his courtroom. That man was Ernest Coulter, and he started the Big Brothers Association to help keep boys out of trouble. A few years later, the Ladies of Charity in New York followed suit, befriending little girls, and so began the Big Sisters Association. In 1977, the two organizations joined to form one, the Big Brothers Big Sisters of America, a mentoring organization aimed at helping change kids' perspective and giving them the opportunity to reach their potential through one-on-one relationships. Big Brothers Big Sisters of Northwest Arkansas got its start 20 years ago. Brittany Gully is development director for the local organization.
Who can be there for them on the weekends or after hours or whenever. So they really kind of got together and just took about 2 years, obviously, to get it up and going with funding and staff and stuff like that. But we're fortunate that we're 20 years strong.
It is in honor of the 20-year anniversary this month that they have launched the 20 Men in 20 Days campaign in an effort to recruit 20 new Big Brothers. So, adult males volunteer less than females?
Yes, I hate to admit it, but I think us women just tend to want to give back a little more, or don't question as much as the men do. You know, people find that their common question is, how much time is this going to take, or how much money is this going to take? And the females don't really seem to care. They want to just give back any way they can. And so sometimes it takes us a little more convincing towards the guys to come out and be a part of our agency. But once they do, they love it. And a lot of times our bigs find that they get more out of it than our littles do. You know, they get to be a kid again and they just have fun. And
that's pretty much the only requirement, to have fun. You heard Brittany say bigs and littles. That's the lingo here. Bigs can take their littles to go see a movie, play video games, go to the park, play ball, things they normally wouldn't get to do if they didn't have a little in their life. It really is just having fun and hanging out twice a month with an at-risk kid.
So they are from single-parent homes. They're from alternate caregiver homes. A lot of our kids live with grandparents, aunts, uncles, friends of the family. Maybe their parents are incarcerated. 1 in 4 of the children that we served last year had an incarcerated parent. Or, you know, the single parent who's just working a lot of hours and just needs somebody else to kind of be there for their kids.
As the requirement is to spend at least a year with your little, many bigs develop quite the relationship with their brother or sister, often texting or emailing about school, tests, or sports outside of the allotted 4 hours a month. The organization served 202 kids last year and aims to help 250 in 2013 in both Washington and Benton counties. The kids are spread out evenly between the two counties, but Brittany says it's more difficult to get volunteers in Benton County, that they're lucky to have the University of Arkansas in Washington County. It provides a lot of volunteers. And that's where this year's Big Sister of the Year is from. However, she graduated this year with her master's.
They've been together for 4 years, and they're like sisters, real sisters now. And so they plan to keep in touch. The little was in her wedding, and they feel like they're a part of each other's family. And so they both kind of get teary-eyed when they talk about, you know, she's moving, but we know we can still pick up the phone or text or email and stay in contact that way.
A success story of sorts. Though success is hard to measure, the national organization held a study in 1995. It showed that youth served by Big Brothers Big Sisters are 46% less likely to use illegal drugs, 27% less likely to use alcohol, 52% less likely to skip school, and one-third less likely to hit someone. In addition, they get along better with friends, teachers, and family members.
Their grades are better, that their social skills are better, that their future outlook is better. So I think that that is success in itself.
Though they are calling for men, the number of boys they serve does not outweigh the number of girls. But due to the lack of big brothers, they often spend more time waiting. For men that are apprehensive and maybe need a nudge from the female in their life, the agency also has a program for couples.
A married couple or a couple who's been together at least 7 years. And then big families would be a married couple that have kids of their own. A lot of times we see like they have teenage kids, and so they want to have 6, 7, 8-year-old little in their life, and they teach their kids at an early age about how to give back to their community and how to get involved. It's kind of a bonus for the littles because then they have more than one big to look up to.
Of course, they will take applications of any kind in the next couple of weeks and any time, but they are calling for men. The 20 Men in 20 Days campaign is on its fourth day, and according to Brittany Gilley, they have received 2 applications. Applicants must pass a background and driver check and attend a 4-hour training session. Also going on right now, Bowling for Kids' Sake, a national fundraiser held at bowling alleys. Big Brothers and Big Sisters of Northwest Arkansas is still taking teams for its Luau at the Lane events July 18th, 23rd, 27th, and August 1st, either at Fast Lanes in Rogers or Ozark Lanes in Fayetteville. For more information or to apply, visit bbbsnwa.org.
This Week in This American Life. It is our 500th episode, and we are commemorating that by playing you the very best moments, and by that I mean the staff's favorite moments of the last 17 years.
As it unfolds, you just realize, like, no, 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 no.
When I heard that, I was like, well, that's one articulate bank robber.
And there's a point where he just realizes, like, oh, she loves me.
The very best moments of our show ever this week.
This American Life, just ahead this morning at 10 o'clock here on KUAF. This week, Bob Durow launched the 15th annual KUAF Summer Jazz Series. His incredible career has included collaborations with Miles Davis, producing records for other artists, and writing many of the songs associated with Schoolhouse Rock. The first Schoolhouse song he wrote was Three is a Magic Number. So, for our Sunday morning montage, we salute the number three. Here are 10 clips representing 11 references to the number three.
Three is a magic number. Yes, it is. It's a magic number. Somewhere in the ancient mystic trinity, you get three as a magic number.
The past and the present. Your Honor, these men should receive their maximum punishment. Their guilt is proved by the evidence and by their evasive attitude. Just look at them. Remember, you have sworn to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Now, were you or were you not on the night of June the 13th in Mrs. Throttlebottom's chicken coop?
Certainly not. I was in the house.
What house?
The dog house.
Just when I thought I was out, they pulled me back in.
Arkansas up 18-17. So happy, good time,
open and wide for lots of chocolate, so delicious, and it's fluffy inside. It's a good time for a good time.
100,000 pesos to come to Santa Poco, put on show stop. The infamous El Guapo.
What does that mean, infamous?
Oh, Dusty. Infamous is when you're more than famous. This man, El Guapo, is not just famous, he's infamous.
100,000 pesos to do a personal appearance with this guy, El Guapo, who is probably the biggest actor to ever come out of Mexico.
You know it's hard out here for a pimp. When you're trying to get this money for the real.
So this movie needed no help from the imagination of a fiction writer. The truth itself was fabulous enough. And all the episodes you're going to see happen to this girl, whom they call Eve White. And much of
we three kings from Orient are, bearing gifts we traverse afar, field and fountain, moor and mountain, following yonder star.
To see a list of all 10 clips and all 11 threes, you can go to our website, OzarksAtLarge.com. Good morning. It is Sunday, July 14th, 2013. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas, and here with me now is Becca Martin Brown, features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
A shameless plug.
Okay.
For my mom.
Okay.
Who is turning 94 today.
Aw, happy birthday, Mom.
And is still clearer headed than any of the rest of us. Of course, she doesn't tweet, Facebook, text, or...
Yet.
Yet. We might talk her into it. This is my favorite time of year.
Okay. Mid-July.
Because we get to talk about season announcements.
Okay.
It's Christmas in July, and we get to talk about the UAFS season of entertainment and the live on stage season.
And I don't think I've really heard much about either of these, so give it to me.
Well, the UAFS season of entertainment opens with a local production from the school, Lend Me a Tenor. The first national touring event is in November, and it's Audra McDonald, who I know from being in the Peabody Award-winning Having Our Say, the Delaney Sisters' First 100
right.
Years. But she's got Tony Awards and Grammy Awards.
And she was just in, I'm drawing a blank. Is this the girl, this is the woman from Private Practice?
Yes.
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 What was she just in?
I don't know.
A revival on Broadway.
Porgy and Bess.
Porgy and Bess.
Yes. Okay, so we've sorted
all
that
right,
out.
There we go. Okay, so she was just in Porgy and Bess.
Like I said, Having Our Say was awesome, you know. But of course, she was also in Ragtime and Masterclass and yeah. So she'll be amazing. Then they have Memphis coming to town as a national tour. Man of La Mancha as a national tour, a UAFS theater production, Crimes of the Heart, the national tour of Bring It On, the musical.
Okay.
And the national tour of the Addams Family.
That's interesting. I didn't even realize there was a touring.
It's apparently all about
Addams
Wednesday
family.
When she's all grown up.
Okay.
So this could be fun.
That could be fun. Wednesday was probably one of my favorites.
You can find out more. Season tickets are $220 and include the national touring events plus the local UAFS productions. And they are on sale through August 30th. Individual show tickets go on sale September 7th, or 2nd rather, at 788-7300. And live on stage, of course, is in Northwest Arkansas. And their concert season starts September 15th with Exile.
Okay.
Now Country. Of course, if you're old enough, you remember the song, I Want to Kiss You All Over,
which I remember that
made
song.
National radio stations get all twitchy. It was lots of fun. Pianist Dale Gagne is next in November. The Jesse Lynch Trio will bring jazz to Arend Arts Center on March 9th. And the Diamonds, which is a doo-wop group, will be there on April 6th. And they wrap up their season with Hal Linden.
Who's Hal Linden?
Well, you might remember him from Barney Miller, which is an old TV show.
Okay.
Not sure you're old enough.
I've heard of it.
But apparently he was a musician first. He's a vocalist. He plays the clarinet, and he's backed in the concert by a 7-piece band. We'll do Broadway tunes and big band numbers. And season tickets for this might be the bargain of the year. $85 for five shows, or $25 a piece at 855-9997.
I'd say season tickets is the way to go. Yeah.
Also this afternoon, Civil War Collections on show at Prairie Grove Battlefield State Park with Ann Webb and Steve Burgess. A Sunday concert, jazz with the Claudia Burson Trio at 2 o'clock at the Fayetteville Public Library. If you're not going to these, really, they're free. They're awesome. Thoroughly Modern Millie, the first weekend matinee at 3 o'clock Sunday at the Arend Art Center, the Ozarks in Springdale. Robin Horn is speaking on Already Set in Motion at 3 o'clock at Crystal Bridges Museum in Bentonville. And Madam Butterfly is on stage at 4 o'clock with Opera in the Ozarks at Arend Art Center in Bentonville, which is where that came from. And tickets for that are $20.
All right.
Go play.
Happy Sunday. Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Spanish composer Manuel de Falla premiered his ballet The Three-Cornered Hat in 1919. Famed for using Andalusian folk music, he also quotes the opening of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony in this ballet. Hi, I'm Katie Henriksen, host of the KUAF Sunday Symphony Sunday night from 7 to 9 p.m. right here on KUAF Public Radio. Join me this Sunday for Manuel de Falla's Three-Cornered Hat.
And this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Berryville. The 2013 Drum Corps International Summer Tour will be coming to Bentonville High School's Tiger Stadium this Tuesday, July 16th. Gates open at 6, show starts at 7. This year's Northwest Arkansas Music on the Move event includes performances by 8 groups, including the Ozark British Brass Band and Music City Drum Corps, featuring a Bentonville High School 2013 graduate. For tickets or more information, visit dci.org or bentonvillepride.com. The Fort Smith Public Library will present a reading, book signing, and luncheon featuring writer and storyteller Oda Malloy Friday, July 26th at noon. It will be held at the main library on Rogers Avenue. The author, a German native, will read from her book, I Grew Up in a Castle. It's about attending a Quaker boarding school in the Netherlands during World War II. For tickets, call the library, 479-783-0229, or visit fortsmithlibrary.org. The Arkansas Public Service Commission is hosting 2 public comment hearings on plans by SWEPCO to construct an extra high-voltage transmission line across North Benton and Carroll counties. The hearings are set for tomorrow in Eureka Springs at the end of the Ozarks Convention Center. The second hearing will take place Wednesday, July 17th in Rogers at the Embassy Suites. For more information, you can call 479-253-8440. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas. Antoinette Grajeda will be back tomorrow, Monday, for an all-new daily edition of Ozarks at Large. Until then, thank you so much for listening and have a good Sunday.